My castaway this week is a businesswoman. In fact, she's just been named Businesswoman of the Year. Married for nearly 25 years to one of the richest men in Australia, she supported him loyally through huge success and stressful failure. When he died suddenly in his early 50s, she was advised to sell up and retire to a beach. She did the opposite. Her husband had just begun to turn the tide which had run against him, and she now took the helm. In the past 6 years, she's created an impressive commercial empire out of cattle, construction, transport and theatres, 10 of them all in the West End of London. She remains a proud and loving widow, unafraid of being on her own. This, she says, is what women have to prepare for. She is Janet Holmes Acourt. Preparing for widowhood may be one thing, Janet, but preparing to take over a multi-million dollar empire is quite another. Was there ever any doubt in your mind that that was what you had to do?
It wasn't actually anything that I really thought about. I just did it.
So you never gave the beach a thought?
Definitely not.
You'd be bored out of your mind.
I'd be bored out of my mind. So no, that didn't really occur to me.
But there seems to have been a suggestion that somehow your husband, Robert Holmes Acourt, had kind of prepared you for this moment. Is that the case?
I'm not really sure about that. One of my children did say that to me as I was going off to the office on the first day, the day after the funeral, to actually start work. And he said, "You realise Mum, Dad's been preparing you for this for a long time."
Do you think he knew then, perhaps, that he might die young?
Well, I'm positive that he knew that he would die young. You can't abuse your body the way he did with cigarettes and stress and overwork and the wrong diet and expect to live for 100 years.
Did you expect as
yes.
well that he would die? So you perhaps always knew this could happen.
Yes, but I don't think I ever thought of it in terms of taking over.
You spent, as I said, nearly 25 years with him and now 6 years without him. How different are you as a widow of 53 from the wife you were at, say, 43?
Oh, I think very different. I think I'm more confident. I'm more, possibly more me. You know, it was a role that I played, the company chairman's wife, and I wasn't really play acting, and I don't regret anything that I did in those 25 years. But I think that I am a more independent, I mean, by definition, I'm a more independent, forceful person. There's nobody telling me what I should or shouldn't do or how I'm expected to behave. I just do what I want to do.
And are you as happy to get up every morning as you were then?
Yes. You have to face reality. The reality is I don't have a husband. He's dead. And if I was to spend the rest of my life saying I can't get out of bed because I'm on my own, that would be a terrible waste of energy in a life. So you face it and you get on with it. So, yes, I am as happy to get out of bed in the morning because that's what life's like.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, my first record is Brahms' Violin Concerto. It's played by Yehudi Menuhin, and we're going to hear the slow movement. Possibly I've listened to the third movement of this more in my life than the second one because as I've got older, I've started to become more interested in slow movements, but I used to be frightfully in touch with the third movements of all the concertos I have in my portfolio, which are all pretty upbeat and rousing. But as I get older, I think my musical taste is orienting me more to slow movements.
Thank you.
part of the second movement of Brahms' violin concerto played by Sir Yehudi Menuhin with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Rudolf Kemper. You did own a desert island at one point with your husband Robert, didn't you, Janet?
We still do. It's not exactly desert. It's very wooded, in fact. It even has a little area of rainforest on it. It's
Where
off
is
the
it?
Coast of Queensland, near Cairns.
That's not then one of the things you sold after Robert died, because you did sell a great number of things.
We sold an enormous amount of things because we inherited, you know, the things and the stuff which were extraneous to what I needed in my life.
Like a Boeing 727.
Exactly. Like a huge house in Regent's Park that required 5 security guards and so on to look after it.
And numerous Impressionist paintings.
Yes, numerous Impressionist paintings. And masses of debt. And a lot of those things had been purchased with debt and they don't earn anything. So to pull the company into shape and make it into the sort of company I wanted, we disposed of all this extraneous matter.
But they were sort of things that gave you personal pleasure, presumably. But why? I think that's what the interesting thing is. Why didn't you need them alone, whereas you did need them when Robert was alive?
I didn't need them.
He did.
I didn't need them. I used to say these things are called possessions because in the end they'll possess us. Robert was the most profitable division that Heytesbury had, if you like. And he could service the debt by ringing stockbrokers and doing a few deals. I don't have that ability. I don't have that interest.
But you personally, it sounds to me, reading about you, live a much more compact life. I mean, having divested yourself of all those things, as you say, I see that quite often when you're in London, you live in a small flat in Soho and walk to work at the theatre through the back street. You sound like a sort of young girl about town.
Well, I used to be honest, I loved that. I had a flat in Soho for 2 years while I found another house that suited me better and then did the obvious refurbishments and so on one needs to do. Being able to walk to the office and walk to each one of our theatres, it was great fun.
And when you got tired of all of that, and when you do now, you can just take off to the outback. Well, what have you got out there? Cattle? Stud farms?
We have a stud farm where we breed thoroughbred racehorses just outside of Perth. That was a great hobby of Robert's and was a very expensive hobby. And when he died, it was pretty much out of control with far too many horses. We've now pulled that into line, and in fact, we make a little bit of money out of it, which is quite gratifying.
So the way to turn this business around, really, was to sell off everything he enjoyed owning and kill the debt.
Well, partly. It was basically to sell the things that were non-income earning,
sure.
Because we didn't have this magic formula anymore.
And they say you own more than 1%, 1.1% of Australia, is
that
right?
That's about right. It does add up to about 1.1% of Australia.
And then a lot of business in the Far East as well, in the Philippines, in Thailand.
Yes, yes.
But where in it all, Janet, do you call home?
I often joke that home's in an aeroplane, but I think I have to call Perth still home. Perth is quite a fantastic place in having lots of advantages over any other city I know. One of them is that it's on the same time zone as every city in Southeast Asia that I need to be in, so I don't have to change my watch. When I go to Sydney once a month for the Reserve Bank meetings, I get chronic jet lag, particularly in the summer, and I'm in my own country, but I can go to Hong Kong and feel fine.
But all of that business and time zones apart and so on, I mean, if you were, you know, ill or worried or miserable, where'd you go home to?
I'm never ill or miserable or lonely.
So you're the lucky one.
But Perth, okay?
Yeah, Perth. Tell me about your next record.
The next record is John Williams, the Australian guitarist, playing a piece of work composed by Peter Sculthorpe, an Australian composer. It's called From Kakadu. Peter Sculthorpe's work is tremendously evocative of the Australian landscape. John Williams, I have met. He is quite one of the nicest people. And this would remind me of what wonderful things human beings can be, and also of Australia. Thank you.
John Williams playing From Kakadu by the Australian composer Peter Sculthorpe. Going back then to the beginning, Janet Holmes, a court, when and how did you meet Robert?
I met Robert at the university in Western Australia. He was born in South Africa, came to Australia for the Olympic Games in 1956, and felt more at home when he stepped off the ship than he ever had in South Africa, he told me. So went home and decided that's where he wanted to be, and came to Australia to study law. I was in my second year of university when he came to the campus.
This was in the 60s?
In the 60s.
You were obviously very active, very gregarious, very active. They say you were very talented, could have done anything with your life at all. You could have gone into politics or the unions or business or whatever. But you decided to really subjugate yourself to him, didn't you?
Yes. I don't think I'd ever do it again, but I don't regret it. And
Did it go, though? I mean, what did you do for him? Did you lay out his clothes
for
him? Yes,
I did, every morning. Read the newspapers, made cups of tea. But I was able to move out and do... I mean, after the children went off to boarding school, which I wasn't particularly happy about, but they did.
But he wanted you with him?
He wanted me with him. He actually would have liked me to be standing right beside him constantly.
The whole time?
The whole time.
But why were you willing to do that? Well, you must have thought about it very hard.
Yes, I thought he was a very special human being. He was. I felt that he had a special talent, a special brain, and my job was to facilitate the use of that brain. And making cups of tea and so on was not what this man was put on the planet for and so on. Now, it's a bit of a nonsense, and I wouldn't do it again, and I don't think young women do that sort of thing today. But it was more common to do that in that time.
And it felt right.
And you were happy doing it.
So. And it worked. I mean, and he became the great success.
Yes,
The great brain led to millions of pounds. Record number three.
Record number three. Well, this is part of the final movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, which everybody knows as the Emperor. It's played by Edwin Fischer. Edwin Fischer is the pianist who played this when I first heard it, when I was about 4 years of age. It's very significant to me, this piece of music, because I remember very clearly watching my mother, she was washing up at the time, listening to this piece of music and crying. And at that time we didn't have a gramophone. And I asked her, what on earth she was, you know, why are you crying, Mummy, sort of thing. And she said that this was so beautiful, and she knew she wouldn't hear it again for a long time. So she was sad, and I think that it was the first time I really realised that music could move someone in such a way.
Of the final movement of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, The Emperor, played by Edwin Fischer, with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler. The crash, Janet, when it came in 1987, hit your husband hard because, as you've indicated, some of his favourite activities were share dealing and currency speculation. They say he lost about £400 million. Is that about the size of it?
£400 million, a lot. Masses. It was very, very traumatic. Very traumatic.
And presumably it meant he worked even harder to try and recoup.
Oh, yes, nobody has ever worked as hard as Robert worked then. He would work any hour the world that he was moving in was an international world, so that if people were awake in New York, you spoke to New York, but that might mean it was the middle of the night in Perth. If you were talking to London, it would be a different time of the day. So it is possible to work 24 hours a day, and he almost did.
Mm. And the pressure would have been huge, because I'm sure there was a lot of schadenfreude, a lot of people delighted that the great acquirer had tumbled.
Oh, huge. I was very upset about that, because there were several journalists in Australia who, quite frankly, had made their careers out of talking to him two or three times a day. He was very good at manipulating the press. And immediately this happened, they turned, and the joy was palpable almost.
But tell me more about his lifestyle. Obviously, in those 3 years then that followed the crash, he was under this great stress, but he smoked heavily, cigars,
yes,
for breakfast?
Yes, always had. Smoked a lot.
Exercise?
No, there wasn't time for exercise. Mm.
Food? Mm. What sort of food do you
eat? Bad food. not the sort of food that the children and I eat and did eat. I mean, we all...
So you ate something different?
Often. Mm.
But you must have said to him during the course, but look, you are killing yourself.
Oh, yes, and I think he was an intelligent person. He must have known that. But his doctor, who's a great friend of mine, in fact, tells me that he said to Robert, if you want to live to be 55 even, you'll have to change your lifestyle. And his answer was, I could do that, but I wouldn't be happy.
And eventually the inevitable happened in 1990. He had a huge heart attack. Mm. Where were you at the time?
We were at the stud farm.
You were with him?
I was with him, yes. It was in the middle of the night. And it was a very massive heart attack.
Did you have time to speak to him, or did he wake you up and speak to you?
Oh, yes. Mm. He woke up and thought he had indigestion, and of course I suspected that it wasn't. And then he had a heart attack. Mm.
So it was all over really very,
very quickly.
So someone wrote at the time that the chess player had gone, and the game would never be the same again, but it did go on, as we've heard, and we'll discuss some more. But tell me first about your next record, number four.
Well, I've been trying to think of what I would miss if I was on a desert island, and obviously the main thing I'd miss would be people. And I have been fortunate in my life in having many close male friends in the truest sense of the word. I actually have about six men who call me mate, and I love it. And many of them have had wonderful voices. Now, Richard Burton was not a man in my life, but he has got a wonderful voice. So I think I would take Richard Burton reading parts of Under Milkwood, also a piece of work which I absolutely love and know quite well, so I could mutter along with Richard.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble street silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now.
Richard Burton reading the opening of Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas. So you took over, Janet, the business as it entered the 1990s. We've indicated that you run it differently from the way Robert did, but how would you characterise the essential differences in the way you run it?
It's totally different. Robert was really a one-man band. The way I've described it is Heytesbury was like a pyramid with Robert at the top and many people paying homage. And they worshipped him and they had him on a huge pedestal. I would like to think that I'm down at the bottom of a pyramid and that I can motivate people, make them feel good about themselves, hopefully inspire them to achieve their maximum potential.
So what does that mean you do that's different? You go out and meet all of those people. I mean, thousands of employees you have, don't you?
Yes.
So
I spend a lot of time with them, but we don't make our money with money in Heytesbury. We make it with people.
But any big decision, like a 2 million on a new feeding centre or whatever would go through you.
So oh, absolutely.
You know, you are very hands-on, is what we're saying. Now, what sort of effect does that have on you? I mean, you must feel under stress. You must feel sometimes like your husband must have felt.
No, not very often. I've got a fantastic chief executive officer in Australia, Daryl Jarvis, who was actually working in the company when Robert died, but in the cattle division. So I've got him on my side. I've got a good board. We now have managing directors in all our operations who are trustworthy, part of our team.
So what you do, which is what Robert didn't, is you delegate, you trust other people.
Yes, yes.
That's the lesson, really, isn't it?
Yes, it's people.
And keep them motivated.
Yes.
But basically stop trying to be kingpin.
Oh, absolutely.
That was his great mistake.
Wasn't it? Yes, it was.
Number five, what's that?
This is part of Elgar's cello concerto in E minor. It's played by Jacqueline Dupré. It's very moving, very soulful. And, of course, the Jacqueline Dupré story is a story we all know. And Sir John Barbirolli, I once heard conduct the orchestra in Western Australia when I was a very small child, and he made it sound so wonderful.
Of Elgar's cello concerto in E minor, played by Jacqueline Dupré with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbirolli. And you have aspirations to be a conductor yourself, Janet?
Yes, I've always wanted to be a conductor. I think that is the prime position in the orchestra.
But you're having lessons. Your children are giving you lessons.
Yes, quite an inspired gift for me. I think they're probably sick to death of me waving my arms around when I'm listening to music. And so for my 50th birthday, they organised for me to have 20 conducting lessons and 20 piano lessons, and then when I've accomplished the goal of being able to conduct something, the hire of the University Orchestra in Western Australia so I can give a little concert to my friends.
So when's it going to happen?
I don't quite know. I've been so busy since my birthday that I've only just started on the piano lesson side and the conducting lessons. I suddenly realised, actually, when they gave them to me, that conducting was probably quite difficult.
More difficult than waving your arms.
Yes.
Let's talk theatres, because, as I said, you own 10 of them, including the Theatre Royal Drury Lane and Her Majesty's and the Garrick and the Cambridge and so on. A third, I think, of the West End seating capacity.
That would be about right, yes.
But you haven't, it seems, concerned yourself so much with what's on stage at the beginning as to what goes on backstage and in front of house.
The first thing that I had to do and that we did when we came into Stolmos in the serious way after Robert died was recognise that we were, in fact, landlords, and that the landlord side of Stolmos had, in fact, been badly neglected for quite some time. That is, the maintenance and the provision of decent facilities for people.
But, of course, people have always said in the past that, you know, these theatres, many of them are historic buildings, they can simply eat money if you're going to put them in order. How have you managed to afford it?
Well, they do eat money. And when people complain to me about ticket prices, as they occasionally do, I have to explain that we have to be allowed to make a little bit of money in our theatres so that we can do the refurbishments and provide the facilities which people demand. They are hugely expensive buildings.
But what you've also been criticised for doing is putting on too many commercial shows. You've got Miss Saigon and Phantom of the Opera and so on. You know, you get the bums on seats, obviously, which is... Do you feel that you should legislate in favour of more serious theatre, or is it just a business?
We have to have a balance. At the moment, we do have Miss Saigon, Fame, Oliver, Passion, Phantom of the Opera. We have five other theatres. We have an Inspector Calls, which thousands of schoolchildren are coming to see because it's part of the curriculum. We've got Tap Dogs, which thousands of young people are coming to see, and we're developing a new audience. We've just had Lee Evans. We packed the Apollo and the Lyric for 8 weeks with young people who had never been to the theatre before. Even if 1% of those young people decides that going to the theatre is an exciting thing to do, that a live experience is exciting and comes back, I think we've achieved something.
Record number six.
This is a track from Jimmy Chai's musical Brand New Day. And this musical was first performed at the Perth Festival in 1990. I went about three times. It was a most moving experience. I was asked afterwards if I would be interested in establishing a theatre company in Australia which would use multiracial casting, which would perform the work of Aboriginal writers as well as other Australian writers. So we set up Black Swan, and 2 years later we actually put Brand New Day together again and took this Aboriginal rock musical to towns like Moree in northern New South Wales, which have dreadful race problems, and showed the people of Moree Aborigines being creative, being clever, being funny, being optimistic. And the title Brand New Day is about reconciliation. Listen to the news, talking about the blues of our people. Listen to the news, talking about the blues of our people. Every day, every day, discussing our way, discussing our way.
Jimmy Chai's Brand New Day, sung and played by the Black Swan Theatre Company of Western Australia. It said you rather resent the Australian stereotypes we're fed, you know, the sort of Barry Humphries slobbering, rather uncouth cultural attaché Les Paterson.
I do. I hate it. I think it feeds English prejudice because I've never met Les Paterson.
I thought you'd met him on a jumbo jet at some point.
Do you know, I actually met Les Paterson on a jumbo jet, but he was English. I actually, once last year, travelling from Singapore to Perth, there were four obnoxious people, and their behaviour was absolutely vintage Les Paterson, but they were all English. Now, no doubt Australians behave like that as well somewhere, but I haven't met them, and I have met thousands of very sophisticated Australians.
So it's time Barry Humphries stopped it, is it?
Yes.
And what of your children, Janet? All in their 20s now, yes. Two of them educated at Oxford. Are they in the business too?
If they wish to be in the business, I'd love it. If they don't wish to be in the business, I think that's fine too. I think it's really bad to make people feel that they have to do it.
I wonder, though, you were saying that you spent a lot of your time not with them when they were younger because they were at boarding school and you were travelling with Robert. I wonder if, in a funny kind of way, you're almost closer to them now than when they were young.
I probably am. I mean, I resent not having been with them when they were in those formative teenage years. A couple of years ago, one of my sons applied for a job for his holidays and sent me his application letter. And I was absolutely staggered that he could have done this. Now, I shouldn't have been staggered. If I'd been growing up with him and he'd been growing up with me, I would have known, I would have helped him with his homework, and I would have known that he was capable of such a terrific application. And I thought, oh, gosh, I really missed out on a lot of fun there.
They must be very proud of you.
I think they are. I'm very proud of them. I think they're all they're all pretty sane, and I'm very proud of
them. So you've all survived. Record number seven.
This is a quartet from Beethoven's Fidelio. I think it's beautiful. I like to sing along with it. I would take Fidelio with me on this desert island because it's Beethoven and it's my favourite opera, but also it's in German, and I studied German at school for 5 years, and I reckon by the time I'd been on this desert island for a couple of years, I'd be able to sing the whole thing, whereas if it was in Italian, I wouldn't have the faintest idea what they were saying.
Thank you.
part of the quartet Mir ist so wunderbar from Beethoven's Fidelio, sung by Adolf Della Pozza, Manfred Jungwirth, Gundula Janowitz and Lucia Popp. So tell me about Janet Holmes' Court on a Desert Island, completely alone, but for her 8 records. Do you find the idea rather inviting?
No.
Not at all?
No, I don't. I'm not gregarious in the sense that I want 1,000 people around me, and I avoid, if possible, going to places where there are too many people. But I do have a special group of friends, and I don't relish the thought of not being with them.
And do you, despite your gregariousness, despite that group of friends, do you also suffer from loneliness?
There's a time sometimes at the end of a concert when people are pairing up with their partners and going off home, when I think, oh, God, I'm going home to an empty house again. To be alone sometimes would be a great luxury, but not forever.
Do you think you might get married again one day?
No.
Oh, you're very, very different.
No, I don't have any religion, so I don't see the point of getting married again.
Let me rephrase it then. I mean, do you see yourself putting your life together with somebody else's at some point?
I wouldn't mind doing that. You get very used to being on your own. It's probably rather selfish, but the habit of being able to do precisely what you want in those rare moments when you are on your own is something that grows on you.
You wouldn't give up easily?
No.
It's quite comfortable existence.
Yes. But sharing maybe sort of 3 days a week or something like that.
Why not? Sounds ideal. Last record.
Last record. I think this is arguably the most beautiful piece of music ever written, and many of my friends and I would like this to be played at our funerals. It's the slow movement of Schubert's string quintet in C major. I play it constantly. It's very sad, so I'm going to be quite sad.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's string quintet in C major, played by the Emerson String Quartet with Mitzlav Rostropovich. If you could only take one of those 8 records, Janet, which one would it be?
I think I would have to take Fidelio because it is the longest one. There'd be more.
And what about a book? Because we give you the complete works of Shakespeare, and
yes,
we give you the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Although you're not religious, you say.
So. No, but I need to read it.
Right. Mm. What about a book of your own choice?
I've decided to take a great Australian book called Tourmaline, written by Randolph Stowe. It's terribly evocatively written in terms of descriptive passages, but it is a universal story, and it's also a novel which Black Swan adapted for the theatre for the festival in 1992 and was stunningly successful. And so it would remind me of lots of friends and happy experiences, but basically it would remind me of Australia.
And what about your luxury?
I think I would not be allowed to take my piano. I mean, I'd like to take my piano and hope that somebody like Harvey Keitel was washed up and wanted lessons, but
You could take a piano, actually.
Could I? Well, I take a piano, but if that was too big for our vessel, I think I would take a jar of Vegemite.
Would you? Why? Tell me.
Couldn't live without it. No Australian could live without a jar of Vegemite.
Janet Holmes, of course, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Sue. It's been a great honour and pleasure.